It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about real-time virus monitoring through air sampling technology and the results of a study in the Oregon School District to monitor and track circulating viruses like flu and COVID-19. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Jonathan Temte is here, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement and a Professor of Family Medicine and Community Health at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Temte, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you so much, Kate, and happy Leap Day to you.
And to you. So you installed these air samplers to test for viruses in some schools in Oregon, the school district south of Madison. Why did you decide on schools as the venue?
Well, schools are really important venues for both the transmission and acceleration of respiratory infections within our communities. And so, using the old adage, why do you rob banks? It's because the money's there. And in schools, that's where the viruses tend to be.
And I understand you've been testing in the Oregon schools for some time, over a decade. Can you talk a little bit about this type of longer-term disease study program?
Absolutely. We have had the wonderful situation of being funded by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention since 2013. And our study was mainly aimed at looking at whether or not we could use absenteeism for a early detection method for influenza in the community. And so since about 2014, we've been monitoring total influenza and or total absenteeism due to illness. And then we look at absenteeism due to a flu-like illness. And what we found is that absenteeism works actually very good in giving us a head start on detecting influenza in the community. We were in place when COVID hit, and so we've been able to do the same with COVID. And it was just a wonderful opportunity to add in some additional methods for looking for these viruses.
And so air samplers now being in the mix and kind of can be able to track things like influenza and circulating COVID. In terms of what these air samplers can do, what about other highly contagious viruses, like the disease measles, can it track for that?
More than likely, the answer is yes, but one has to be cautious because one really has to do the testing to make sure that what you're seeing in the air sample is actually what is happening within the population. So one has to be really, really cautious because if you have a false positive signal, basically identifying something that really isn't there, the public health response cost is really, really large. So I think we have to be careful in the application. The good news is for both influenza and for COVID-19, we've done that preliminary groundwork, and this methodology seems to work actually very well.
We're talking about air sampling to detect viruses with Dr. Jonathan Temte at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Call in with questions. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Temte, what advantages are there in testing air samples for viruses rather than, say, physically testing people in a community?
Well, first, the air sampling is actually very, very easy. You put a device in an area that there are a lot of people, for example, a cafeteria, you turn it on, and then you just come by occasionally and pull cartridges out. Secondly, air sampling is totally anonymous. So we're getting results, but without tracking it to an individual person. And so for people who are concerned about privacy, this really is a nice technique. And I'd say the third thing is it isn't really behavioral dependent. So when we're doing our studies, we're dependent on parents calling in saying that they have a sick child. And there can be a lot of things out there that will prompt that. For example, the news media is saying, oh, we're in the middle of a flu epidemic, that might prompt parents to be more likely to call into our study line. So the error sampling provides us a tool that is pretty unbiased, it's anonymous, and it gives us good results.
So I imagine researchers have learned a lot about the spread of disease since the arrival of COVID-19. And you were testing for COVID in the Oregon schools. How did the spread of COVID respond to things like masking or physical distancing and school closures?
Wonderful questions. Well, I have to admit that I think our team detected the very first case of household transmission in the state of Wisconsin back just a little bit over 4 years ago now. But the things that I think are really important out there is that we found through another system that we have been monitoring households within our Oregon school district, that there were some profound effects on what the school district did. So initially, on the 13th of March of 2020, schools shut down basically across the nation. And what we found in households that were part of our study, the respiratory infections totally disappeared very, very quickly. During the first fall, when students came back, but came back with hybrid education, so only half of them were there at any time, they had mandatory masking and they had distancing within schools, we found that there was very little respiratory virus transmission going on. The following year, students came back with mandatory masking, but without distancing, without hybrid. And sure enough, we saw some viruses leap back into circulation, particularly the common cold virus or something called rhinovirus. And then the following year, when kids came back without masking, without distancing, without hybrid, it was just kind of the Wild West. There was everything circulating very early and very intensely. So we have a really nice set of information that we can look at what the school was doing and what the response was within the community.
What you described there is pretty ideal for researchers to make some really important strides here in understanding, how our viruses circulate and how to shut them down.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the benefits we've had, as I mentioned early on, is this continuous funding. And when we finish up, it will have been 11 years. And that is really, really, really uncommon within epidemiology and within the scientific community in general. So we have been very, very lucky.
So, how would detecting viruses through these air samplers, these systems, how would that augment other detection methods? Is it a complement to other methods?
Yeah, absolutely. In our studies, we actually have 10 different methodologies that we're all doing at the same time within the same population. And we're able to compare them with each other. In the paper that we published recently, we looked at four of those. But now we're doing some further analytics on 10 different methods. And what I'll say is each one has properties that have benefits and advantages and some that have some negativity and costs and so on. And at the end of the day, I think any group who is interested in monitoring might have a whole palette of different techniques to choose from and adapt for their local circumstances.
We have Dr. Jonathan Tumpty with us, Professor of Family Medicine and Community Health at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. You can be part of the conversation on air sampling, monitors, virus surveillance technology. Call in with a question, add comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore tech advancements and disease surveillance, and we unpack results of a study published in JAMA Network Open about the effectiveness of air samplers to detect the presence of influenza and COVID-19 at sites in the Oregon School District. Call in with a question. You can share thoughts along the way at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Jonathan Tempty is Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at UW School of Medicine and Public Health and lead author of this study. Dr. Tempty, let's get into a bit of the nuts and bolts here of these air sampler devices. How do they collect and test genetic material?
The devices are pretty much like a small vacuum cleaner that's constantly pulling air out of circulation and pushing it through a small filter that's designed to capture genetic material. The cartridge is then removed, and in this study, the cartridges were being removed twice a week and going to the laboratory of Dr. David and Dr. Shelby O'Connor up on the UW campus. They extracted the genetic material and then tested it in their laboratory for the presence of influenza and for SARS-CoV-2 or the cause of COVID-19. So it's a fairly straightforward process, but I would also argue that it's not necessarily easy or cheap at this point in time. So this is not a type of approach that one can go into a hardware store and pick up the components and have it up and running. This is something that in our situation was really a research endeavor.
I would imagine too, when there is an outbreak, speed matters, your timeliness and knowing matters so you can make critical decisions, whether you're a school or a nursing home. How rapid could the turnaround results be on air samplers?
Well, one of the things that we've been interested in using are some of the small devices that have been created, designed, and marketed for very rapid detection of pathogens. So, for example, there are tools that are called rapid molecular detection tests that can give a result within, let's say, 30 minutes of the time that a sample is taken from someone's nose or presumably from a cartridge. So stay tuned for this, but I think the arc that we're seeing is toward cheaper, faster, and higher accuracy.
Could these cartridges that are pulled out of these machines, could they be used, could they be reused or recycled? What is the cycle here for waste?
Well, this is a great question that I would probably defer to my colleagues, Dave and Shelby O'Connor. But they have explored in creating their own cartridges, and the material is actually very, very small. The cartridge is about the size of, let's say, a large pen. And so they're actually quite small. The other thing is these can be checked or pulled out at any period of time. It could be done daily. It could be done twice a week. It could be done weekly. And so these are all protocols that, let's say, are, you know, in the process of being worked out.
And how portable could these units be? Could you move them around a facility based on the needs or the collective areas where people might be congregating?
Yeah, absolutely. These are the size of between a toaster and a toaster oven. They're actually very small, compact, lightweight, and easy to move.
Do you imagine that costs would eventually come down with this technology? And do you think there's a demand for it?
Well, I think one has to think in terms of where the most appropriate place could be. And as I mentioned earlier, schools are really important hubs of transmission, particularly for things like influenza and SARS-CoV-2. And even things like, if we go back in time, measles. But we have to also think about where are the highest consequences. And those might be more in terms of our long-term care facilities, where we have congregations of much more vulnerable individuals. And so in a school, what you're doing is detecting the occurrence of a pathogen in the community. In a nursing home, you're looking at the arrival of a pathogen in a highly vulnerable population. And if you're able to intervene early on, you may be able to save illness, hospitalizations, and deaths. And so one has to really cautiously and appropriately apply the technology to the situation.
Talking with Dr. Jonathan Tempty at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and research on air sampling technology to detect viruses. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. How soon, timeline here, how soon could air samplers be installed in large numbers of public places? Do you see a future for that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think my colleagues have been working a little bit deploying these in places like points of entry, airports, international arrivals. And again, as opposed to requiring or asking passengers to submit a nasal swab, this is pretty much hands-off and anonymous. And so it can provide that early warning without really being a intervention that causes delays, causes other consternation. So I think I'd say stay tuned and let's see where this technology goes.
When I was reading your study, there were things that you're comparing with, like swabs, as you mentioned, and absenteeism. But I also saw the word dogs in there. And, that's like being like seeing that little shiny thing on the side. Where do dogs come in circulating viruses?
Well, that was mentioned in our introduction, and
Yes.
just as to the variety of things that people have looked at. And there was a school district, I believe in California, that looked at whether or not dogs could be trained to recognize the scent of a person or a child infected with COVID. And it showed moderate benefit. But that also brings up the whole issue of wastewater sampling.
Yes.
And all I can say is our state lab of hygiene is a center of excellence for wastewater surveillance, looking for things like influenza, COVID-19, and RSV. And so there are all these technologies that are being developed simultaneously, and we'll see which ones have the most promise.
So, if there is another widespread pandemic, the tools in our toolbox now, have we learned a lot here? And are air samplers a tool that could be readily used in the future if we're in the face of another pandemic?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we have to leave all of our cards on the table and again, apply them appropriately for the situation. But again, the air sampling can give us this early warning. It can detect things in very small amounts. And I have to just insert right here that we're not detecting viruses that are going to be infecting people in the air. We're detecting the genetic material. So one has to be cautious in interpreting our results, saying, oh my goodness, the air is contaminated and we're going to be sick by walking through this cafeteria. That isn't the case.
Quick question here in our closing moments. Kevin in Janesville wonders if this technology could sample large buildings like a prison or a mall.
This is really dependent on the number of people in an area, the airflow. So if there's a high rate ventilation system, it's going to be less effective. And so it really depends on the situation. And again, part of the studies that my colleagues, David and Shelby O'Connor, are doing are looking at things like the airflow and the most appropriate deployment or location for these devices to be.
Dr. Tempty, thanks for joining us.
Well, very welcome and thanks for having me.
Dr. Jonathan Tempty at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.